I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be speaking to writer and director Haifa Al-Mansour about her sophomore film, Mary Shelley, a biopic of the Frankenstein author starring Elle Fanning in the titular role. So this film is romantic with a capital R, so I'm just going to try and work out which romantic writer you guys connect yourselves with the most. Well, we'll start with you, Amy, who's frantically Googling on her phone. Amy Watts is joining us this week.
Hi, Amy, FYI, I'm just getting notes up.
Okay. Which romantic writer?
Romantic writer?
Yeah. I think maybe you're...
I don't really read a lot of romance.
Who wrote the notebook?
No, we're talking like romantic with an R, like the romantic era.
Yeah, okay, the romantic... what about the poet... What's her name? Elizabeth Browning?
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to get that out.
I like Robert Browning, who I think...
Oh, sorry, Keats.
Yeah.
Keats.
Oh, Keats. Take that back, yeah.
Yeah, you're going to go in Keats?
I'm going Keats.
Stephen Ryder is also here. I'd have put you for Keats.
Me?
You seem like a proper romantic at heart.
I feel like a Byron.
You feel like a Byron?
Yeah, I feel like a Byron. But thank you, Sam, for the compliment.
That's all right. And Kelly Powell is also here.
I think I'm also Byron.
No, you can't have Byron. Do you like The Outside? So that we're going for long walks in the countryside?
Yes.
Okay, Wordsworth.
Okay. Let's go with that.
And you, Sam?
Yeah.
Well, this is a podcast. It's not a visual medium. But I will say that if you want to know what I look like, just Google Lord Byron. Because I do look exactly like a certain oil painting of Lord Byron.
Slightly.
So I was in English literature A-level. And in this classroom, there were portraits all around the room of like different authors. And there was a Lord Byron one, and my teacher suddenly stopped the class to point it out to everyone that I looked like Lord Byron.
Wow. So it's not a new thing?
No. This has been going on for years. Years. And this is Miss Rendell, and she would continue to call me Byron throughout the remainder of my years at that school.
Amazing.
Morning, Byron.
That's what she said. So British.
So, as ever, please email us if you have any thoughts on the films that we discuss on the show, and we'll read them out during the podcast. You can contact us, podcast@curzon.com, or check our Twitter @CurzonCinemas for our reply call-outs. So, Mary Shelley is the biopic of the Frankenstein author Mary Shelley, played here by Elle Fanning. The film was written by Emma Jensen and directed by Haifa Al-Mansour. This is a follow-up to Wajda, which was a huge success, critically speaking. And she was the first Saudi Arabian woman to direct a film. But before we get into that, I just want to ask you guys, have you all read Frankenstein? What did you know about Mary Shelley before you saw the film?
I shamefully have not read it, but now I desperately do. And her other novels as well.
I actually have read Frankenstein, but I knew nothing about Mary Shelley. So for me, Frankenstein was always just kind of a cornerstone of horror literature in the same way that something like Dracula was. Mm-hmm. And it never really, because I read it at quite a young age, I don't think it ever really clicked with me that, we're talking about an author who was 18 when she wrote this, and talking about a woman as well who probably at the time was kind of looked down upon for writing such a kind of piece of gothic literature. So it's nice to be able to come and look at something that's kind of been such a bedrock of culture and of horror culture and of literature, and kind of look at its genesis and its beginnings, because it does kind of put a whole new perspective on the book.
Excellent. I read it at uni as part of my degree, and I wrote an essay on it.
Part of the film degree?
No, because I did film and English Lit.
Ah, okay.
This was part of the English Lit side of things.
Very nice.
So how do you feel about it?
Of the book?
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think it's, because I did it, the module was romanticism. Because the film is like littered with all these like famous names, and like people just crop up and they mention like Coleridge is taking them on a walk, and Polidori's there and Byron's there. So I read it in concert with all these other writers. There's a lot to dig into in this film. When you're an English student and you just find anything to pick apart and think, great, that's my angle. And there's a lot going on in this book. And as you say, it's incredible that she was 18 when she wrote it.
Yeah, it seems as though, like, thinking about it now, looking, if we were to look back at this film in 10, 15, 20 years' time, it probably is a very useful film for kind of literature students at a young age
to watch. That's what I thought was the best thing about it, for especially, like, 15-year-old girls. I think she'd be quite a good introduction to feminism as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we very rarely get kind of biopics about authors that really dig into why they made a work, where that kind of work comes from them personally. I hadn't thought about that until you just mentioned kind of English literature class.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can see people looking back at this film when they study Frankenstein, which will be studied, I think, for a long time to come.
It's made a bit family friendly, isn't it? Like, the sex scenes aren't very explicit. So I felt that the audience was quite a lot teenage girls.
Yeah, so that's... Of this film, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I was saying to Stephen earlier, that it did kind of feel a little bit like a teen drama, because I guess they were all that kind of age.
Yeah.
And I did think about, you know, what kind of audience she was appealing to. I thought it was a good sort of way to access her story and those kinds of ideas.
Okay. So without further ado then, let's have this week's interview. Haifa Al-Mansour came to London a few weeks ago, and I had the pleasure to speak to her. Okay, we're delighted to welcome to the Curzon podcast Haifa Al-Mansour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So we're here to talk about Mary Shelley, which is your second feature film. Now, I imagine after the success and the acclaim after Wajda, that there were many different directions you could go to, many different projects you could get off the ground. So why is it Mary Shelley that is your second film?
I really wanted to break into a bigger world, and I wanted to make an English film, and I got a lot of scripts, but I did not connect with them.
Okay.
And when they sent me this script, I was also surprised, and it's like, it's Mary Shelley, like a period. And then when I read it was amazing to see how much she accomplished in a place where women not expected to accomplish much.
Yeah.
It is a period of time like where she was even dismissed when she wrote something that is unfamiliar, and they didn't want her name to be on it, and wanted Percy Shelley to write the introduction.
Right.
So I really felt like I knew how much it hurts when you are dismissed creatively, and I really sympathized with her journey, and I really wanted to tell that story. I felt like it's important for us women to claim Mary Shelley and put her into the spotlight, because that gives us legacy and allows us to be strong. If someone is doubting our success, we can say we have people like Mary Shelley who been doubted before, and look what happened.
Yeah. Mary Shelley is perhaps one of the most famous writers of all time. So what is it you wanted to convey about her for this film to people that already know her? And what kind of character did you want her to be within the film as well?
I wanted, like, for Mary Shelley is very well known, but the monster is way more well known.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it is very present in pop culture, in cartoon and films.
Yeah.
And I wanted to claim that monster. That is, that production is, a lot of people describe that book as Frankenstein as a masculine piece of work, and it is. We wanted to say no. It is not. It is masculine because it's brave, because it conquers new frontiers, because it's not like anything else. All these attributes usually are not given to women, but I wanted to give something. More. it is everything happened, and all the themes in the book are direct relationship with what happened to her as a woman, like the loss of a child, being obsessed with death and re-giving birth because she had the burden of her mother's death and losing a lot of children and the exhausting relationship with her husband. All these things are important in creating the themes and creating the book, and they are all a result of a woman's life and her suffering. So that was very important to show for me in the film.
Okay. And why did you then pick Elle Fanning to be the one who brings that to us?
I was fascinated with Elle since Super 8 her ability to bring a lot of elegance to the roles she plays, even as a kid.
Right.
And then when they brought me the script, and they gave me a list of actresses and all that who are in the same age. And I felt like she is the best person to embody that, because she has this elegance and effortlessness. Mm. And this role could tip into being a little bit more melodramatic because of the death of a child and all the relationship. Yeah. And you wanted someone who has this kind of effortlessness and can elevate the role and bring a cinematic feel to it. And Elle was the perfect, also because of her age, and we wanted to shock people how young Mary Shelley was when she wrote the book, and it's exactly the same age. Elle was 18. Oh, okay. She just turned 18during filming. And Mary Shelley was 17 when she wrote the book.
Wow, okay. And so you were sent the script, which was written by Emma Jensen, but you're credited as a co-writer. Can I just ask, what was it that you either changed the script, or what it is what you brought to the script?
I did a lot of, the third act when she goes to the publisher and she gets dismissed. And I felt it's very important to put that in the story. Yeah. I also felt the relationship between Mary and Claire should come into... The two sisters should not be about jealousy and fighting over men and all that. Yeah. I think it is a bigger journey of two girls escaping a world and finding both of them understanding the journey of a woman at the time. And that is why I wrote that scene when Claire, I don't want to spoil it for your for your people, but when the there was a very moving scene.
Yes.
I feel it's moving because I wrote it, but towards the end when between Claire and Mary, and I think I thought it's very important. I also, there's a church scene.
Mm.
I wrote that because I feel it's very important to question paradigms for writers like Percy and Mary Shelley if they will bring something that is important. And I feel it is the creative process needs a free mind, and that is having that free mind, you need to go into questioning paradigms at the time, and that is hence that is why the church scene.
Okay, and you've spoken a fair amount actually about Mary Shelley as being a writer when it wasn't perhaps so common for women to write these kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did you see this kind of parallel between yourself trying to make films in Saudi Arabia and Mary Shelley trying to publish Frankenstein in these cultures that didn't necessarily have women doing these things?
Absolutely. And that is one of the major things that I took that in telling Mary Shelley, because I know how it hurt to be dismissed creatively. When I started making films in Saudi Arabia, people used to make fun of me because at the time movies were illegal, making films. They're, cinema theaters were illegal and nobody makes films and there is no money in them. And it hurts, when you are young and trying just to have a voice, to be ridiculed in public too, in a magazine, in newspapers will say things. And now it changed, and it is now time to celebrate people like Mary Shelley, because it is at the time maybe people dismissed her because of her gender and age, but that is the product of that time, and now we are different. We appreciate women, and we want to give them the recognition they need, and it's about time to give Mary Shelley her recognition.
Yeah, and can you talk about some of your memories of working on Wajda and under those kind of more constrained circumstances and the censorship in Saudi Arabia at the time you're talking about when you were writing the film, and then also comparing that to perhaps more of the freedom you had with Mary Shelley, like this very different sort of production
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was very grateful to be not to be filming from a van in Saudi Arabia. Like, it was segregated at the time when I filmed. Saudi Arabia changed a lot, though. Yeah. Now we have a film commission. There is a film fund, and they open movie theaters. So it is not the situation anymore. Right. I have to say, but it is at the time when I filmed. It was difficult, and it is But I feel this film has its own set of challenges. Like, it was co-produced, so we had a lot of money coming from different countries, and we have to film all through across Europe. And we got a lot of money from Luxembourg, which looks nothing like England, even from a girl from Saudi Arabia. I could tell that is not England. So we filmed a lot of the exteriors out in Dublin, and we had to build a studio in Luxembourg. And literally, we'll take outside in Dublin, and we finish the scene entering the door in Dublin, and we finish the scene in Luxembourg. So there is a lot of visually cohesiveness that took place. And Packy Smith, our production designer, did an amazing job. And the weather was something really challenging. And I remember in the last scene when the two girls running running under the fake rain, it was like freezing cold. And we had heaters and people just waiting for them at the end of the scene. And we had to repeat three times. I felt awful having the girls run through it again. But it is they gave a great performance. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so it's been about 5 or 6 years since Wajda.
Yes.
And, you know, as we record this now, a few nights ago in the UK, in London, there's a group called the Dispatch Feminist Moving Image Collective. They showed Wajda in a cinema. So it's still, people are still in love with the film, and it still is being screened and everything. Can you talk about the impact that's had, not just in Saudi Arabia, but also like in the world, like people still really feel close to this film?
I think it's about a young girl questioning the system and having her own, like, trying to be happy. And that is a story everybody can relate to. And it is similar even with Mary Shelley. Like, I find myself fascinated by strong women.
Yeah.
I really, it is in my DNA, I think, because of where I come from, to tell stories about women who are not victims, women who are trying to succeed, and women who succeed in being happy and creating things. And maybe the circumstances are not perfect for them. Maybe things are hard and challenging, like it is very hard and challenging for a lot of women, but it's not excuse for us not to succeed. We should fight, and we should always try to be. And that is the way we can pave the way for a newer generation of women who want to do amazing and achieve a lot of stuff.
Yeah, okay. And so even looking at the two films you've made, and even in like the films that you have coming out that I don't know loads about because they're not out yet, but there's some information online, there is very much the young female voice being represented, or like, as you say, not in perfect conditions, but trying to succeed. Can you talk about how you saw the representation of women in film before you started directing, and now after, as a director?
Absolutely. There is, especially in Hollywood now, and it is amazing to see how much women, there's the Me Too and Time's Up movements have opened doors for women. And just like creating a safe place for women to work, not to be harassed, and to be able to feel appreciated for their talent and hard work, and not to be dismissed. And I think it is really that we are in a feminist reawakening, I would say, in the world when it comes to women. So it is so much different than when I started working. But still, I think the image of women being in an authority figure, like a director, is still not there yet.
Okay.
Like, I just finished my third film for Netflix called Napoli Ever After, and sometimes they will announce the director is on set.
Yeah.
And I feel like really good. People are announcing my presence, right? I was just like happy. And then when I go on set, people try to find where is the director, and I'm there. Mm. Because I don't feel the image of the director, typical image. So still, there is so much to do. There's so much work. But I think we are in the right direction.
Okay. And do you think things like Netflix are allowing more of these kind of films to get made, of these smaller films or films from people who we don't
don't fit the typical image, or like you say, the typical image of the director.
Absolutely, but I think there is, it's on Netflix and other, like even the studio systems now, that we see a lot more, like Wonder Woman was directed by a woman and starring a woman, and it was one of the highly grossing films of all times. So it is like now changing, like the female representation behind and in front of the camera has changed, and equal pay for women is now on the table. It is discussed, and agents are fighting for their female clients, and so it's changed a lot. And it's just like there is so many mediums, like you said, now to present film, which is wonderful. But still, I think the big screen is and has its charm, and we can't live without cinema in public.
And my last question then. So you mentioned that, you know, was it a 35-year ban in Saudi Arabia of the exhibition? Have you shown Mary Shelley in Saudi Arabia yet?
I think we will. Okay. It's just like and didn't have its Middle East premiere. But it's amazing to see Saudi Arabia just opening up. Yeah. And I've just been appointed by a royal decree to oversee. Yeah, that is amazing to oversee the development of art and cinema in Saudi Arabia. And it's wonderful to see a place like Saudi Arabia, who's traditionally very conservative and very militant, and people see themselves against the world, celebrating art now and enjoying music in the street, and that will change the mood in the Muslim world, and because Saudi Arabia sets it for the rest of the neighboring countries, and people look to Saudi Arabia of how to interrupt religion, for example. So it is really it is wonderful to see Saudi Arabia opening up and embracing modernity and becoming a normal place where women drive, where women enjoy music, and everybody can go to the cinema. So it is. It's a greater change. It's a reform that we all should be behind, because introducing art in a culture is that what it elevates it and makes it more tolerant and more accepting of others.
Brilliant. Haifa Al-Mansour, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Okay, so this is Haifa Al-Mansour's follow-up to Wajda. Amy, you're part of the team that screened Wajda a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
As part of the Dispatch Feminist Moving Image Collective.
Exactly, yes, well remembered, Sam. I think there are similarities in this, because it follows like a rebellious teenage girl going against the social norms of her society. And it seems like Al-Mansour likes to show the world from the perspective of young girls. Mm. What did you guys think? Have you seen Wajda?
I saw Wajda when it first came out. And yeah, it's really nice and obvious how Al-Mansour's career has gone so far, and clear, it's very clear what her kind of preconceptions are about film and what it should do. And I think that this is a very natural progression for her to make a film like this. Although it feels like it's very odd for her to want to make you discussed this in the interview, for her to make kind of a film away from Saudi Arabia and England as her second feature. It's a big decision to make, I think. You know?
Well, when you look at the content, it can make sense, you know, who she's focusing on. Mm-hmm. Because obviously it's clear that there are similarities that she kind of identifies with this person, Mary Shelley, who fought against, you know, male dominated society, and a woman who kind of was fearless in the sense that she was going to make art, the art she wanted to make, no matter what. And obviously, she's done that as the first actual filmmaker from Saudi Arabia, but not even female filmmaker.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the way that she's sort of changing culture and the way film is being sort of received and seen in that country, I think, is quite pioneering in itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense in that way.
I think if you kind of flip the script, and what's kind of impressive about Mary Shelley, I think, is if you flip the script and you take a British director and tell them to go make their second feature a period piece in Saudi Arabia, I think they'd be lost.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's more of a kind of foundation to build on when you're talking about British period film rather than Saudi Arabian period film. But still, I think that kind of the having the ability to kind of just completely switch your location but still maintain your kind of core beliefs and your core kind of themes in your film is a very impressive thing to do, I think, for a filmmaker, and a very brave thing to do as well.
Totally. Well, she said that she identified similarities in this period in Britain and Saudi Arabia now, the confinements women have.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting as well, like, not just from her point, not just from why she decided, yeah, this should be my next film, but why the producer or whoever thought this should be made by Haifa al-Mansur. Like, they saw something in Wajda, they thought this is perfect for this story. Because I'm surprised that there hasn't been a proper Mary Shelley biopic before.
Yeah.
Because she's probably, maybe apart from J.K. Rowling, the most famous female author.
Well, like, in the Jane world. Austen.
Jane Austen.
The Brontes.
I don't know. I just feel like, you know, I think Mary Shelley maybe. I don't know.
Virginia Woolf.
I think she's definitely a name that people know, despite the fact that kind of she only had one major work, I think, Mary Shelley.
Well, she's known for Frankenstein, but she did go on to write novels after, but they don't have as much
resonance.
I think it's because she kind of stands out because of what she wrote, you know, that it was just so not appropriate for women to write that kind of story at the time. I think that she's kind of an outlier in that way. And I think that's why she's sort of well known for that.
Yeah. I think that you mentioned, Sam, that there hasn't been a proper biopic made of her before, but I don't know if any of you guys have heard of Gothic, the film Gothic by Ken Russell, which I saw in terrible quality a few years ago, but it's literally a film that's set in the one night the house where the two kind of books were written. And it's so, so different from this film.
Yeah.
It's full of sex. It's full of horror imagery. It's very kind of phantasmagorical because that's the kind of director Russell is.
Yeah.
So I think that when people have approached this idea of Mary Shelley and her work before, they've really kind of gone with the Frankenstein imagery and like the gothic imagery of it. And I feel like Al-Mansur hasn't done that. She's gone for something very different. This is a character-driven film, and it's kind of very much based in reality. It's a period piece, but it's kind of realism at the same time, I think.
She could have been, there could be lightning everywhere in the film, and Mary Shelley is this kind of weird goth character, this goth outsider.
There was a lightning scene, though, wasn't there?
One lightning scene. Yeah, you're right. I remember when that happened, I was like, oh. But yeah, fascinating stuff.
Also fascinating that it takes like an hour and a half for her to even start writing Frankenstein, pretty much.
Yeah, it's when she goes to the reanimation show.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting stage show for the period, I think. He has a lot of electricity going on, a little frog with his legs bouncing up and down, kind of reanimated. It's really interesting, actually, that's the time when she starts to think about science and kind of and monsters and things like that. But it is an hour into the film, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about Mary Shelley herself, then. First of all, how well is Elle Fanning cast as Mary Shelley, do you guys think? Interesting casting an American actress in the role. And then, branching off from that, what kind of character is she portrayed as and presented as compared to what you kind of knew about her before?
Well, I thought Elle Fanning did a good job in portraying the gumption of Mary Shelley, and that she comes across very determined, and she's not afraid to challenge anyone. She's surrounded by these sort of respected male poets and authors, but she still gives her opinion. I mean, there's one scene where Byron says to her that he doesn't believe that women can be intellectual enough to form their own ideas and opinions, and she's like the perfect antidote to that, because mm-hmm. she is full of fire. I mean, I think she might even says that, like, I've got fire in my soul. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Mm. So I think she played it well.
I think she's a star. I mean, I love watching Elle Fanning. I really do. I think in
Stephen
anything...
Stephen loves Elle
Fanning. I think in anything she's in, she's she has this very kind of ethereal presence to her, which is why I think the role of Mary Shelley is an odd one for her to choose, because this is a very kind of like, we get told everything about her life. There's not really any mystery left around Mary Shelley once this film is finished. She's not kind of situated as this kind of enigmatic figure. She's very much like somebody who's got needs and somebody who's got desires, and you kind of are told very directly what they are. And usually in her films, Elle plays like a very kind of dreamy, kind of mysterious young woman, like in the
20th century.
Maybe in 20th Century Women, she's a bit of like a dreamy girl in that, I think. But like in
Neon Demon,
Nicholas Winding Refn, Neon Demon, she's a very mysterious character in that.
Yeah, and even the Beguiled as well. Like she's not given any, backstory or anything. That character, she's just kind of thrown straight in with her.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's a strange decision, but I think like, she's at a point in her career now as well where she has the star power to kind of lead a film at such a young age as well. Yeah, and she's, I think she's very, very good in this. I just think she's great to watch. I think she's doing something in every scene she's in. Mm-hmm. But it is the scenes that you mentioned, Amy, where she kind of explodes into like a rage, and a deserved rage as well, I think, where she really shines.
There's a great quote about her that her dad uses. You're at war constantly with everyone and everything and enjoying all the battle.
Mm. Oh, I thought he says that about her mother.
The mother.
Was that about the mother?
Yeah, it was about the mother. But he did say that, like, he sees the mother in her, definitely. Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing as well, this whole, the way her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, is kind of, not in the film at all, but very much in the film at the same time.
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, yeah.
That was, like, a really exciting thing for me to watch. Like, the fact that she's almost like a ghost that... Like, Mary Shelley's never actually met... her mum.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell that she looks up to her and carries her with her throughout the whole film. And
well, she really sees... I think that means that Mary Shelley sees the kind of effect that kind of strength and determination can have on the following generation. And that's what, you know, writing something like Frankenstein meant to her.
Yeah.
And that's why she wanted her name on this work so much. She didn't want... Well, I forget what she says to Percy... She says something like, you don't get it. You don't get the point. What's the point of me writing a story if my name isn't on it, or something along those lines? I mean, I think.
She does say that to someone at some point.
Yeah.
What's the point of writing a novel what's the point of writing a novel if you can't own the words? Something like that.
Yeah. Which I think is really, really important to the film. That this, because a lot of things look at this story as this kind of very kind of... intrinsic like thing, like that is the story, nothing else matters but the story. But Mary doesn't see it in that way. This is her story, and this is a story that she wants to tell, and that's so important to her. And I think that comes from the fact that her mother had such an impact
on
her
and
life.
Her dad is a radical as well. I mean, she brought up in this liberal, radical, educated household, so no wonder she is the same.
She had the belief that she could be whatever she wanted to be. And it was that sort of determination, I think, that... Because I can only imagine how difficult it must have been in that time to have these ideas and, like, want to live your life in that way and just be so utterly repressed in the society that's just like, nope.
she says about her household being stifling, and I think that's how she found, like, the conventions of marriage and things.
And
like
I think that the stepmother was sort of the epitome of all of those ideals for her, which is why she felt sort of... She often said in the first, like, half an hour that she felt suffocated, you know? Like, and I think that was both metaphorical.
And it's interesting that they got Elle Fanning to play a role like that, because maybe what they get from Elle Fanning is this kind of... a look that's very kind of weak... In a way, she's got a kind of very nervous looking
angelic
face.
Look.
Yeah, angelic and kind of naive.
Innocent.
Naive and innocent. But like when she clicks, like there's a fire that comes up in her, and she's able to kind of really look. She can, in with the flip of a switch, go from like, you know, naive and innocent to kind of like strong and someone you don't want to cross. And I think that's maybe something that is she's going to explore in her entire career. She does the same thing in Neon Demon.
Mm.
She goes from being like a nervous newcomer to kind of the fashion scene to a kind of a demonic presence.
You love this film.
I don't love Neon Demon, actually. I think Sam's Demon. I'm really ambivalent towards Neon Demon. I think it's
I
got
thought
a lot
it was really interesting. Anyway, that's not.
Yeah,
the
no,
about,
it has got
really
it has got a lot of problems, but I think. Yeah, I think that's kind of a cornerstone at the moment for Elle Fanning's career, and I think that's why I keep coming back to it, because that was her first kind of really, really kind of adult role.
Big adult role, full-on lead in the film in every scene,
face was
almost.
On the poster.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And I think since then, despite the kind of mixed reviews of that film, she has people have noticed that she does have the star power, and that's why things like Mary Shelley have come about. Yeah.
And the rest of the cast then, so you've mentioned Percy Shelley, played by Douglas Booth, who's very much known for being in these kind of costume dramas. He's a more complex character than I remember like hearing about him, because at uni we did study Shelley a bit, Percy Shelley, and you learn a few things about him, but I didn't know he was this kind of complicated and had these like varying conflicting views and political opinions. And
how accurate is Percy's story, do you know? Because I felt like he was kind of the antagonist of the film.
Well, he doesn't come across well. I mean, doing some research after, it does come across that he basically went and off and had all these flings with women while Mary Shelley was dealing with depression from the multiple deaths of her children. But yeah, I felt like he could have been portrayed a bit more complex. I don't know, I just felt like he was the bad guy.
He probably had a huge influence on the work, right?
Oh, no, of course.
Yeah, like
the actual physical writing of it.
Oh, no,
I'm not sure about that. But
well, that's what's debated. I mean, obviously he was a inspiration almost for...
Well, she was an inspiration for him too. Like, that's the thing. Like, you know, she... A lot of the work, the romantic kind of poetry that he was writing at the time was inspired by Mary, I think.
By Mary and by Claire as well.
Yeah. And so...
And Jane later on. There was a Jane that, you know, he stopped writing about Mary and moved on to Jane.
And he was a very established kind of artist at the time. And she was not. So, I wouldn't be surprised if he did as much as he could to help her get her work published. However, I think that she most likely wrote every last word of it.
Yeah, some researchers think he like almost co-wrote it. Some say he just kind of basically was an editor.
Yeah, a bit like a publisher would.
Yeah, like literally helped out with the grammar and changed a certain word here and there. But all the story, all the dialogue, all of that, everything, you know, the words was her.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think it has to be that way. He is a relatively complex character in this film, I think. I think he has a very weird thought process about what marriage and love should be. Yeah. And there's that very interesting scene where he says to her, you can basically sleep with whoever you want. It doesn't bother me. And he thinks he's being like a hero there. He thinks he's being a good guy, saying like, I will love you no matter who you sleep with. And she's saying, hold on a moment, like, that's not what I want.
Is like, that how you read that scene? I was like...
Yeah, that's what
he's basically just saying that so that he can have the same liberty.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, because they're both meant to believe in free love, though. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But maybe practicing it for Mary isn't as...
But I think that's actually Elle Fanning's best scene in the film, which he says, I will fight for anybody's right to live how they want to live, but I also will fight for my truth. And I think that's really, really powerful. And kind of prescient for today as well,
of course.
I think. Like, that just because you fight for somebody's cause doesn't mean that you want to live that kind of truth yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a really important kind of message, I think, that the film wants to get across.
Definitely.
Yeah, so let's talk about how the film kind of escapes being this stuffy period drama with these modern themes. And that's a big one, like you're talking about there. Mm. And I think that's one of the key lines of the film. Because at the moment, everyone's like, you're either this or that. You are on this side of the fence or that side of the fence. And... Mm-hmm. If you're on that side of the fence, you take in everything that's on that side of it. And there's no picking and choosing. If you believe in this person or this thing, then you believe in everything that thing stands for.
Yeah.
Whereas this film actually has a bit more of a mature response to things like that.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think that that's true. The film, especially their relationship, I think that I was actually really surprised by how liberal the characters of Mary and Percy and Byron are at this point in time. It really exposes how the romantics and the poets at the time were so kind of sexually liberated and kind of politically liberated as well. That really surprised me.
Rebels of their time.
Very much so, right?
Yeah.
Like, very
much
so. Which
is, I read a quote this morning that Almansur said to the Irish Times, and I think that her whole point of focusing on Shelley and why she thinks she's an important writer was because that she was dealing with content that wasn't for a woman of the time, quote unquote, and her own standing in you know, film in Saudi Arabia, she said that women now can be rebels and still succeed, you know, and that's why, like, Mary Shelley in the time that she sort of was writing, that wasn't really a possibility, and she defied the odds. And now in a time like this, you know, I think we should all remember that you can still be cultural pioneers in, you know, this day and age.
What I found interesting about, you know, you were talking about there are grey areas.
Mm.
And I felt that she was constantly battling with, like, her principles and her desire, and they often clashed. And there was a scene in it with the painting, The Nightmare, by her mother's lover, Henry Fuseli.
Mm. I love that painting, by the way.
Same. And that's my favourite scene in the film. Okay. When they're discussing love and, how, you know, she was saying about her mother, like, how strong she was, but she was also really vulnerable in love. And I think for people that identify themselves as feminists, sometimes there's this conflict of, you know, you have to do what is meant to be feminist, but then you've also got your personal desires that conflict with that. And I thought Elle Fanning really portrayed that well. There's a scene where she meets Harriet, Percy's wife, and you can see that she's a bit conflicted within herself. Like, you know, I've got this woman in front of me who wants me to sort of get out the way. Yeah, she doesn't know whether to go with him or... I thought that was really interesting.
Well, I think that, yeah, you're right. And one train of thought would be that she should step aside because she shouldn't be kind of ruining somebody else's life. But the other train of thought is, why not follow her own kind of desires and instincts? Why kind of repress herself in order to appease somebody else, which is the whole kind of idea of what Almanzar is trying to get across. A total lack of repression in society is a good thing. They are conflicting. You're absolutely right. They are conflicting, and it's a kind of very moral grey area. And I think that that's why the film works as a character piece. And that's why it takes so long for us to get into the Frankenstein stuff, because we don't want to just know where Frankenstein came from. And the genesis of that one story. We want to see before this and the whole point leading up to Mary Shelley wanting to write a novel. Just that. It doesn't even need to be Frankenstein. Why does she want to write a novel? Why does she want to make a name for herself? And that first hour of the film, I think, is really necessary to bring that, you know, bring that to the fore.
The other character I wanted to talk about that I really liked, actually, was Claire Claremont, Belle Powley.
Mm.
And I think Belle Powley is having a really interesting career after Diary of a Teenage Girl. But I thought her character gave something really interesting dynamic to this kind of... Because for a while, they're kind of a trio, aren't they?
Mm.
And I think she has a different energy to everyone else in the film.
Well, you can tell that she's not from two radical thinkers. Like, her mum is conventional, and she is kind of thrown into this world with people that have been more educated than she has, and she's sort of just riding the wave of hedonism. Like, she's drinking a lot. She's very impressed by Byron and likes his attention. But you can see that she doesn't quite have the same strength that Mary Shelley has to deal with these kinds of philandering men.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think she's a strange actress. I think she's got something about her for sure.
Yeah.
But it's an odd role, I think, for somebody to play kind of second fiddle to a character like Mary Shelley, and someone that you're kind of suspicious of
all the time. Yeah. Yeah. The way that she was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they were most definitely lovers, apparently. Percy Shelley.
Yeah.
And Claire.
That was alluded to.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, Mary Shelley, even though that happened, she still stuck by her sister and was there for her and wasn't really jealous of, or at least appeared not to be jealous of that. I mean, even after, you know, we only see her life from 16 to 18, but apparently, you know, they moved to Italy later on and Claire came with her and, yeah.
Mm.
What a hanger-on.
Well, doesn't she talk about her mother living in a menage a trois?
Yes.
I think she's kind of embraced that.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Free love, baby.
Free love.
Yeah.
Isn't that the David Brent song in The Office?
Free love on the free love highway.
Yeah.
They should have just had that playing over the end credits of this film, really.
All right, let's wrap up there then. Any final thoughts on Mary Shelley?
I think it's a great segue to her work and this period in time.
Can we just talk about the kind of notes at the end of the film that come up and how many of these people in the film died so young.
Wow, yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
All the babies died.
All the babies and the sister.
No one lives past 30. Shame.
I mean, I think Mary lived past, was the only
she
one to live past 30.
She lived 53.
Yeah. Yeah. But then you look at someone like Percy Shelley, who's this big kind of figure in romantic literature, and he died at 28 years old.
Yeah.
Is
drowning.
How old I am now.
Off the shore of Italy in a sailing boat.
Yeah. Suspicious.
Byron died in Greece.
Yeah.
But also it shows how harsh this period was to live through.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Had
absolutely.
So much to contend with. And no wonder she actually wrote a story like Frankenstein at 18 when she had, like, in those 2 years, she really had to grow up.
Yes.
Yeah. And surrounded by death.
I think that's really important to note is that you had a smaller period of time to make your mark on the world back then. And I think Mary Shelley really knew that and took advantage of that and, like, powered through this incredibly, like, frustrating period of her life from 16 to 18 where she made some, honestly, radical, crazy choices as a human being to run away from home, to join with this guy she kind of barely knew and who was very liberal and kind of radical thinking. Mm. And she ran off at 16 years old and still managed to create one of the great kind of works of literature. It's an incredible story. And I think the film does do it justice in a way.
Mm. Absolutely. So that's Mary Shelley, which is out in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema today. Also on Curzon Home Cinema, My Friend Dharma is now available to watch, as well as Western. Mm. And a film we discussed a few weeks ago, In the Fade, you can still catch that on Curzon Home Cinema. And we actually have an email response about In the Fade.
Did you send this email, Amy?
No, I didn't, actually.
So this is from Gerard Corvin. He says, emotionally, the film is on point and never felt like it was playing just for melodrama. But ultimately, why does the film need to exist? Okay, unfair question. But the state of nation feel that Akin brings to, albeit subtly, seems to ask for such urgency. My issue was, where was the risk? We have a protagonist who is relatable for EU and US audiences. She is us rather than them, grappling with an evil that comes from within. Nazism is something we can all condemn without the social and cultural problemizations that exist, especially for liberal-minded folk, of which I include myself, around other forms of terrorism that besets the world. The film does much to rile us with the limitations of justice, such that by the third act, we were willing the Kruger character to mete out revenge. I really can't read it, sorry.
Now I get the thing that he said.
What was the thing he said about the title?
It was all too easy, I thought. I also don't think the film really delivered on demonstrating inbuilt unconscious racism on part of investigating authorities and society more widely. I would like to have seen more of that and less of seeing the Nazis pay. So in all, it's a fine courtroom thriller, but not much more than that. Also, the title makes no sense. She is in a state of transition, so it ought to be Into the Fade. That gave me Silver Linings Playbook levels of irritation from Gerard Corvin. Sorry, I butchered your email, Gerard.
Can I just come back to
Gerard? Can I
say
the typeface is really small on my laptop? I'm really trying to read it behind over the mic.
Yeah.
Amy, I feel like you've...
Yeah, got
Amy's
something.
Been like
he is squirming right now.
Dying to say
something.
Well, I just think Gerard is maybe thinking too much from his own perspective there, you know? That's just assuming that everyone like him is watching this with the same viewpoints. Mm. And also, the title, maybe he didn't listen to our last podcast because, you know, it came from the song by Queens of Stone Age and he would have known that if he had listened.
And did you guys hear what Fatih Akin's next project's going to be? Stephen King's Firestarter.
Oh, cool. Mm. Yeah.
Which is a really interesting
That's a really good book.
To choose. It's a great book.
Film Drew Barrymore?
Yeah, very Cronenbergian as well, I feel, a lot of that kind of stuff. So it should be interesting, because it's obviously about a young girl as well, with fire powers.
She's a Firestarter.
She's a
twisted Firestarter.
She certainly is.
Well, I'm a big fan of Akin now. So,
yeah, well, there you go. I think this is going to be a really interesting project.
I think that's going to be very Stranger Things-y.
I hope not.
I said that to annoy you. You know Stranger Things? You like Spielberg?
No, I've
You like
E.T.?
No. You like Poltergeist?
No, isn't that set in the 80s?
I believe it is set in the 1980s.
Oh, wow. I
80 years
have got
after
that.
1900.
I really wouldn't have got that.
Do you know kids had bikes in the 80s? and they liked popular culture.
No
time.
Way.
Yeah.
No, you're kidding me.
Familiar with Ghostbusters. If you have any thoughts on Mary Shelley or any other recent releases, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com for next week's show. As ever, you can find us on iTunes and Acast every week and subscribe, leave a review and a comment. And that is it from me. It's goodbye from Stephen.
Bye-bye.
Bye from Amy.
Bye.
And bye from Kelly.
Bye.
Thank you very much and see you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.